Eastern Europe. Daniel Nelson was born in Minneapolis. He was a graduate summa cum laude from the University of Minnesota in both history and political science. He got his master's degree and his PhD degree from Johns Hopkins University. He taught at various places in one way or another, but more permanently was associated with the University of Kentucky. Most recently, he's been senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment. And his bibliography attests to the areas which he has written about. There is a forthcoming St. Martin's Press book, Guns, Butter, and Politics in Eastern Europe and the USSR. Another book, The Balkan Imbroglio, is to appear, I believe, at the end of the year. He's written on Romanian politics in the Ceausescu era and on elite mass relations in communist systems. One of his interests that spans East and West is the study of leadership, charismatic leadership in modern political systems, being one of his major works. We're very pleased that in addition to being a frequent television commentator and professional society discussant on these issues, that he would join us for a discussion this morning on Eastern Europe in transition. It's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you. I was particularly impressed that Professor Thompson did that from memory, which suggests that he knows how to do these introductions, I think. There's a skill there. That there's an audience back in this other room is a little unusual. I can see that the Miller Center definitely needs this this auditorium that's being built next to us. I was warned that during the meeting today there will be construction noise. As long as the walls hold, that's all I'm concerned about. So I want to talk, you know, the topic's a very general one, but then again, the interests that you have are probably broadly distributed in terms of American foreign policy and, of course, leadership issues as well as international relations. So it's all well that the topic is a broad one. What I propose to do is to talk a little bit about several matters related to Eastern Europe. Number one, I want to talk a little bit about what's happened, and of course in that I will have to paint with a roller, not with a brush. You know, it's going to be a broad portrait rather than intricate details. Second of all, I want to discuss a little bit about why some of those things have happened in Eastern Europe. And finally, I'll turn to a little bit of prognosticating, crystal ball gazing, and other things that in think tankdom we're supposed to do, apparently. I found out recently that that now that I'm not acting as a professor, that I'm a think tanker. I didn't realize that there was such a word, but apparently there is. Well, first of all, what happened in Eastern Europe? A little bit of a preface is necessary, of course. Part of what happened is that let me just tell you a bit of a story. As I was teaching in the fall of 1989, finishing up teaching at the University of Kentucky, which is whichever way is west here, you know, just that way a piece, I was teaching a course on Soviet politics. In fall of 1989, of course, was an auspicious time even for teaching Soviet politics. I had selected a textbook for this course in the spring of 1989. That's typical professorial activity. You select textbooks for the following semester and the bookstore orders them and so on. Well, I ordered the textbook, and the textbook came in, and all the students bought the textbook. And along about the second or third day of class, I told the students to bring that textbook into the classroom with them. I won't tell you which textbook it was, because you would write to the author and say, did you know what Nelson did? And anyway, what happened was, I don't know if any of you saw the movie that starred Robin Williams some time ago. It was called Dead Poets Society. And in that movie, Robin Williams played a teacher, a creative writing teacher, kind of a semi-serious role for Robin Williams. Anyway, he tells the students to come into the class and open the book to a certain page. And he says, now rip out all the pages. And because he didn't like the way this textbook was describing how to be a creative writer. Well, emulating that, I told the students to open to page 21 of this textbook, which conveniently was where the historical section ended. You know, the textbook about Soviet politics has a bunch of pages about czars and all of that good stuff. And so I told them to get to page 21, and I said, now, rip out all the pages afterwards. Well, some of the students looked a little bit puzzled by this. You know, they had just paid $9.95 for a paperback version. I said, look, you don't have to actually rip it out, but don't read them, because it's absolutely useless. In other words, here I was teaching a course, and in the span of about 6 months, the textbook for that course had become ancient history. The textbook talked about the leading role of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, talked about the absolute prohibition against autonomous organization. The textbook talked about the stifling control of the KGB over society, the centralization of the economy, and all of those things. Well, by late 1989, it was clear that all of this was unraveling fast. Now, of course, it's still unraveling, and it's not entirely gone, but the point is that you couldn't teach from that. Why do I tell this story? Well, partly to get a chuckle or two, but partly it's the notion that what has happened in the part of the world that I study and the part of the world that several of the people in the room have studied and worked in, what has happened is an enormous and fundamental transformation that, at least in the last couple of generations, has been unequaled. That isn't to say that it's unprecedented in the scope of history. I'm not suggesting that. Some of you clearly can recall other points in time when there were equal or greater transitions, but this one is momentous. Obviously, what has happened at the very simplistic level is that communist parties were forced to retreat from positions of state authority. You've heard the term revolution used many times to reflect on what happened from the Baltic to the Bosporus, from Poland through East Germany down to Sofia, Bulgaria. I'd suggest that the term revolution is probably misleading in terms of what happened in 1989 and 1990. A better term might be to say that what happened in 1989 was the culmination of a lengthy period of change that one might even call a silent revolution. Now, of course, that term isn't mine. That actually is a University of Michigan political scientist named Ronald Engelhardt. He was referring to Western Europe, but be that as it may, I'm fully able to steal terminology. And silent revolution, in a sense, was what was going on over the 1970s and 1980s in Eastern Europe and, to a degree, in the Soviet Union itself. Some of this is revealed by public opinion data. Not perfect public opinion data, not Gallup-Harris polling, but nevertheless incremental bits and pieces of information where we saw antagonism towards these regimes increase. Some of this is revealed by organizational activity. It could be Solidarity, Charter 77, the Lutheran Church in East Germany, and many others. Some of it is indicated by the the incremental rise of the number of strikes and job activity, that is to say, slowdowns. What I'm trying to say is that there was evidence building that these systems ruled by communist parties, let's not call them Marxist, let's not call them socialist, but countries that were ruled by communist parties, were incrementally losing their grip on authority within these political systems. I've written some pieces that have tried to argue that what we were seeing is a gradual rise of public legitimation. And 1989 was the point at which it reached the precipice and went over, not at the same moment in all of the countries, but nevertheless the rise of public legitimation. Over the 1970s and 1980s, while communist governments were still in control, they began to backpedal and began to do things like talk to opposition groups, in some cases, move away from absolutely rejecting any kind of responsiveness to public demands. There were organizations that were beginning to form that were, if not desired by the authorities, at least they recognized that they couldn't outlaw them entirely. To put it another way, Communist Party regimes were unraveling gradually. And so 1989 then becomes not a revolution, but the denouement, the end of the final stage in a revolutionary process. Now, if you accept that as kind of a general description of what happened, then you should be asking, well, then what didn't happen? I think that in the United States we make some mistakes about assessments concerning what happened. I don't think, and here I'm making an argument, and some of you may wish to disagree with me on this later, but do save it till later. I mean, if you get up and walk out now, I guess that would be a tragic happening, but I don't think that what happened was that capitalism won and socialism lost. I don't think that what happened was that democracy won and some kind of communist rule lost. I don't think that what happened is that the United States won and the Soviet Union lost. I don't think there were necessarily victors, and I don't necessarily think there were those who were defeated. I think the Cold War meant for many, many people losses across the board. Now, that doesn't mean that what happened was not, in one sense, a vindication of Western values. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I don't think that capitalism caused the defeat of. I don't think that the United States caused the defeat of. I think the defeat, what happened in 1989 is the culmination of a decade and a half or more of unraveling. I think that that process was caused, if you will, by the inherent weaknesses of these systems. Communist rule did not work. It did not produce. It did not perform well. Added to that, if you will, were the courage and conviction of human beings in these countries. To put it another way, what happened in Eastern Europe was the failure, the abject failure of a particular kind of system, a one-party, ideologically driven system, Leninist in its model, plus the real victory of the people in Leipzig, the people in Timișoara, Romania, or perhaps the people in Budapest and in Prague. These were the people who won. And the cause of their opportunity, in a sense, to win was the abject failure of these systems to perform. To say anything else, to credit the demise of communism to NATO, to the United States, to any particular American policy, I think would be taking away the credit from where it's really due, which is to the people who were courageous. And of course, failing to recognize that the real loser in this was this model of Leninist party, one party, ideologically driven rule. Well, let me switch a little bit and ask rhetorically, which I then will try to respond to, why did all this happen? I've already given you some hints as to why I think, reasons I don't think contributed to the events. Of course, one model, one explanation of why there were these massive changes in Eastern Europe that are continuing in the Soviet Union now, with only Albania kind of holding out, maybe Serbia and Yugoslavia. Why did these changes occur? One favorite response is that Gorbachev, that Mikhail Gorbachev made it happen. That on his back, in his hands, whatever image you want to portray, rests the transition that we've seen, in, particularly in 1989, but since he assumed power in the Soviet Union in 1985. Now, there's some truth to that. It is Mikhail Gorbachev who has ended the doctrine that we had referred to as the Brezhnev Doctrine, the notion of limited sovereignty. It was he who said, no, we aren't going to intervene in Eastern Europe. But I reject the notion of the great man of history being the principal cause and effect, cause and, in a sense, proximate reason for what happened in 1989 and 1990. I reject that because anybody who took over the role of General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in 1985, anybody, would have had to have made significant changes. Indeed, they should have been attempted earlier. But by 1985, they would have had to have made those changes. Otherwise, they would have watched a massive rebellion far more violent and far more convulsive than that which we have seen in the Soviet Union. And it was not only Mikhail Gorbachev who had made these kinds of analyses. There were many others long before him who saw the need for economic reform and so on. Many of you in the room know about the Lieberman reforms during the Khrushchev period, or the Lieberman ideas of reform, know about Kosygin and his efforts to reform and so on during an earlier period as well as part of the Brezhnev, early Brezhnev troika. Well, I don't have to go over those to say that there were notions that the system had to be reformed. I don't credit Gorbachev with causing all of this tumult that we have seen since 1985. At very most, he acknowledged what was probably going to happen anyway, and if he didn't open the door, it was going to happen in a much more violent and convulsive way. I also think that we ought not credit, as I've already mentioned, U.S. foreign policy per se. Indeed, bear in mind that by 1985 and 1986, because of U.S. budgetary deficits, increasing foreign debt, and so on, the military buildup that we had seen in the early Ronald Reagan presidency was beginning already to turn around then. So in other words, if we try to suggest that U.S. foreign policy is the proximate cause of this, I think that we're looking at something that had already begun to backtrack by 1986, 87, and certainly by 1988. Internal causes, I think, is where we have to look for the explanation of events that took place in Eastern Europe and are still taking place in the Soviet Union. To put it bluntly, people, I think, caused, if you will, 1989 and 1990, and before that, had caused, because it was their attitudinal disaffection from these regimes, had caused these countries to begin the transition to unraveling authoritarian rule. You will recall the formation under duress of autonomous organizations that were born in the underground and gradually came above. They were, of course, Solidarity, then outlawed in December 1981, that continued its life underground, Charter 77. But not only these, there were others in other countries that lived an underground existence in difficult circumstances, formed even in Bulgaria and Romania and other countries that continued because of the courage and perseverance of individuals. I think that this popular explanation is the most powerful one. But what were people motivated by? Let me go back to something I said earlier. They were motivated by the failures of these regimes, not by external conditions. The failures in economic performance, the failure in political performance. These countries, the communist rulers, did not provide what some other individual political scientist has said were political goods, not to mention economic goods. It's not just that the shop shelves were barren, but also that in terms of the provision of sheer equity, fairness, in an effort to be pseudo-egalitarian, they denied basic fairness and equity to the population. And of course, rule of law, that basic precept of any kind of legitimate authority, was lacking and was acknowledged as lacking, or you could see that it was lacking by virtue of the antipathy towards these regimes and the population. So why did these events occur? I think it was at the mass level, among the people. I think that's where the credit is due, not the high politics of American foreign policy, NATO, Warsaw Pact confrontation, and so on. It was their rejection of these regimes that did not provide both economic and political goods. Well, the theme that I'm trying to drive across then is to look at what has happened in a different way, as a gradual process, not just 1989 and 1990, by the way, a process that is continuing. And second of all, to look at it, these events, as being caused not by something we did, by one man, by a victory of one over another, but rather by failures of these systems, by popular awareness of those kinds of failures. Let me turn to talk a little bit about what kind of prognosis then for these systems exists in the near term, and if I'm real brave, I'll put on pretend I'm in kind of a crystal ball gazing mode here, and look further ahead. We all hope that what Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union will eventually reach, or parts of the Soviet Union, will eventually reach is some notion of democracy. We can debate about what democracy is or isn't, and I know of no clear-cut definition, but suffice it to say that it must be a government that engages in regularly scheduled elections. It must be responsive. It must be characterized by the rule of law. And some fundamental precepts like this, I think, are absolutely prerequisites. I have to say that my judgment, and probably the judgment of many of the other people in the room who've looked at these countries, is that the prognosis is highly varied and not altogether good for some parts of Eastern Europe and some constituent parts of the Soviet Union. There seem to be much stronger processes, much stronger sentiments, other than commitment to what we would call democratic precepts, that are operating both in the countries of what we've called Eastern Europe and Union republics or parts of the Soviet Union. Some of these sentiments are nationalistic, not necessarily linked to a particular ethnic group, but focused on the glorification of the strength of the state and nation. Some of the other sentiments that are very powerful are ethnic identity, and when the two link up, ethno-nationalism is a particularly volatile brew within Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Some of the other motives that are stronger than democracy per se have a lot to do with just economic subsistence. In many of these countries, Poland, certainly the Balkan countries, Romania, Bulgaria, parts of Yugoslavia, and many parts of the Soviet Union, economic subsistence is at issue and is not a sure thing by any means. By the way, I just returned from Moscow, and I can guarantee you that as we speak, not only is there a great deal of tension, there was when I left some desire that Mikhail Gorbachev would take emergency powers, almost dictatorial powers, in order to guarantee basic economic subsistence. Democracy is out the window, in a sense, if that rudimentary subsistence level is threatened. My point is that democracy is what we desire, we looking in. Democracy is what many of the peoples there want in an ideal world, but some other things intervene. For example, strength of nation, existence and protection of their ethnic identity, language, culture, and in addition, economic subsistence is an issue within this part of Europe. It's important to remind ourselves that in Europe, malnutrition, infant mortality, other issues are a vital part of daily existence. Again, particularly in the Balkans, parts of the Soviet Union along the southern rim, and so on. Now, let me just take a moment, not too many moments, because I think that if you're in an audience like when I'm in an audience, you prefer to ask questions and simply listen. Let me just do kind of a quick cook's tour over parts of Eastern Europe and offer little snippets of opinion. These are opinion, by the way, but I hope backed by some experience in the region. Poland, let's start at the top. I guess we could start in the Balkans, but we'll get there eventually. Poland is certainly not guaranteed a democratic future. I wish I could say otherwise. Beginning in January, pursuing a plan drafted by Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard University, Poland launched what I call cold turkey capitalism. That is to say, yesterday it was socialism, tomorrow capitalism. A very rapid, wrenching turnaround of the socioeconomic system from central planning, state ownership, to no planning and private ownership and entrepreneurial activity. Thus far, there's good news and bad news about that. Inflation is down. There are things on the shelves. The reason why things are on the shelves is because no one can afford them. Prices have shot up enormously. And Poland is in a deep recession right now. They are selling goods abroad. Their balance of trade is improved and so on. But industrial output is way down and employment is way up. And it probably won't turn around. Hence, Lech Wałęsa's desire to run for president. He will now run for president of Poland against the current prime minister, also a member of the Solidarity organization, which no longer is a single organization. Mazowiecki versus Wałęsa will split asunder Solidarity. It will leave it in shambles. The clear potential as unemployment increases is for more labor unrest. I don't think that the prognosis is at all sure. And Lech Wałęsa is a charming an individual as he is, as courageous as he was, in my view, this is strictly a personal view, not Carnegie Endowment or anything else like that. But Lech Wałęsa as president of Poland, I think, is a dubious prospect. He may win. Right now, it's rather close in terms of public opinion polls. But I don't think that his notion of Polish foreign policy, his notion of domestic policy, would be very clear or well formulated. I think that that's an issue for Poland's future. And there certainly are people to the far right, Polish nationalists, who would be very volatile if they had any role in government whatsoever. People who claim, for example, land to the east, capabilities to make, if you will, the military give up some resources, but they will fight a rearguard battle that the CIA and DIA and so on now recognize a downturn in Soviet defense spending. Witness the just released volume on Soviet military power, which used to tout, you know, that the Soviets were 10 feet tall. Now it's saying, you know, that they are diminishing their expenditure. We know that their deployments of ships, their sailing time in all oceans has decreased very severely. Their training time for pilots has decreased very significantly. Their production of main weapon systems, still far in excess of ours, mind you, main battle tanks, for example, but nevertheless has been halved, still remains three times ours, but nevertheless, it's very, very substantial cutbacks. So this does indicate a movement on the part of the military. Now, of course, the real question is, what does it mean to have a sufficient defense, reasonable sufficiency? You know, what does reasonableness mean? You know, razumnaya. What does it mean in the terms of how the people in the military vis-a-vis the political leadership interpreted. There have been debates for the last 4 or 5 years about this, especially the last three. It has been vehement. There have been vehement debates in print and a severe division within the military. So Gorbachev is, of course, relying on and leaning towards the part of the military hierarchy that supports his position, that the military can be cut back. There are some estimates, you've read them no doubt, that unlike CIA estimates that said, 14, 15, up to 17% of the Soviet GNP was in the military, now a quarter and above. There are estimates that what's the figure that I had quoted recently, something like 37% of all industrial output is within the military. Yes, and that is beginning to come down, but it's beginning to come down in a rather telling way, and therefore, apropos your question, there are many military enterprises that had been producing military hardware of various sorts that are now putting out, you know, refrigerators and other things. You know, the tank factory that now makes refrigerators that look like tanks, you know, that sort of thing. And the problem with that conversion process is, first, that it's not very efficient, because to make a factory do something that it was not geared up to do, you know, to make a transition that is very significant, is highly inefficient. You know, the workers won't know how to do it, the machinery won't be precise, and all of this. But in addition, those enterprises are staying within the defense ministry. So you may be the manager of a defense ministry plant, and you're now told, still as a manager of the defense industry plant, to produce something for the civilian sector, but you're still in the defense industry sector. It's just you're producing something for the civilian usage. There is concern in the West, certainly in NATO headquarters, certainly in the Pentagon, that this is kind of keeping these production lines warm. Not, and conversion is a very difficult and controversial topic. In November, by the way, as part of a Council on Economic Priorities project in New York, working with an institute in the Soviet Union, I'm going back to the Soviet Union, and allegedly, I'll let you know if it happens, allegedly I'm going to get to tour plants that have been converted. So if I see those refrigerators with tank treads, you know, little turrets instead of doors, But it is a very difficult process, one that I think is being undertaken reluctantly by the higher echelons in the military. They are critical of how rapidly Gorbachev is insisting on it. And it is a nip and tuck rear guard battle by the Soviet high command. Soon they are going to have a smaller military to equip, and that suggests some of the perhaps acceptance of this notion. Bear in mind, though, that not only does the conversion cost money, but also the destruction of any equipment that they've taken out of service is costing a lot of money. And so, the military commanders are aware of all of this money that's being spent in the process of disarmament. And that's part of the reason why they're opposing this process.
Wilson Newman?
Someone from the Outer Limits.
Yeah.
This is just to prove that this is not the silent room. Your presentation is very impressive and influential, and I compliment you in every way I can about it. Up to the point that I have one reservation, and that is...
I knew a but was coming.
I don't agree with it. And my comment has to do with creating an atmosphere in which the Russian event, and I'm referring to the earlier part of your comment, that we would be mistaken if we thought that we didn't significantly influence what happened. While you were talking so eloquently about the necessity for having a formula of ethics, nationalism, and economics that would vary in application of their priorities dependent upon the geographical location. No reference has been made to the transfer of information around the world. The idea that the Voice of America has been operating all over the world is ostensibly now forgotten, and that the people did it. Well, why did the people do it? When I was in China some years ago, traveling around, we could get the Voice of America everywhere. When jamming stopped and came down, the Berlin Wall came down. Would you venture a comment that the motivation of the people was because they saw, heard, or believed that there was a better way?
Good question. Communications certainly played a role. I would imagine many of you in this room are supporters of things like Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and so on, Deutsche Welle, BBC, Foreign World Service. All of these things, plus the expansion of other kinds of data transfer, even the microcomputers, videotapes, cassette tape recordings, all of these things enhanced the possibility that it contributed to the popular or mass recognition that, yeah, there was something else. I think that they knew that anyway. I'm one who believes that there is a certain fundamental wisdom in most populations, kind of a lot of belief in the masses. And I don't think that whether it was people in Poland or Czechoslovakia and so on, they didn't have to wait until these more modern events of the 1970s and 80s. And of course, bear in mind that the first revolts against Communist Party rule occurred really before Voice of America and Radio Liberty were really cranking out much in the way of encouragement to do so, particularly 1953. By 1956, yes, Radio Free Europe was operating, certainly did contribute in, if you want to use that term, to the events in 1956 in Hungary. bear in mind that these kind of popular revulsion to authoritarian one-party rule really didn't depend on those kind of information bases. I think it may have accelerated the process somewhat. How to measure that, I don't know. But what I'd be willing to say is that it probably accelerated the process somewhat, particularly the enhancement of videotapes and cassettes, distribution of that kind in the 1980s. But what it contributed to, in a sense, goes back to what I said earlier, namely popular antipathy because of the failure of the systems. You know, the system had to be failing for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the cassettes, the videotapes to have any effect. If the system were in fact growing, performing well, providing goods and services, not just the shelves were filled, but the rule of law was assured, you know, it could have been a one-party system. It could have been, and there wouldn't have been a revolt per se. You know, the notion of triggering antagonism towards a political system, I don't think is ipso facto dependent on there being just a one party that is ruling. I think it had to be the failure of that system to provide goods, both political and economic. That enabled, in a sense, Radio Free Europe and VOA to have something to talk about. And I think, and then their talking about it enhanced and accelerated that movement towards what we saw in 1989.
If all of you are going to come back in two or three years when Professor Nelson tells us about his prophecy, why, we better stay reasonably within our limit.
Well, but you'd probably make me eat my words two or three.
We're already 15 minutes over. Al Fernbach and Colonel Foote and others have questions. Mr. Newman is pointing to one question, but one last question there.
I want to ask you a real quick question. A year or two ago, I read a book by a young man who leaving Harvard in the early 80s. He received a fellowship to travel in Europe for a couple of years. I think his name was Paul. And it was called Stealing from a Deep Place. And he traveled in Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria. And the book, I think, was written in the early 80s. Certainly the traveling was done. I don't think the book was published until a few years later, but I think it was clearly published well before the regime in Romania fell. And he left absolutely no doubt in my mind that Ceausescu and his regime were clearly tyrants. And I can't remember, maybe I'm not that well informed, but I remember the image of Ceausescu in the American press as being the leader in Eastern Europe on a white horse. Dared to thumb his nose at the Russians. And I think he got the red carpet treatment in Norway and England, even. He certainly did in this country, and he certainly did in our press. My question is, why did this happen? And if so, and the second part of it is, how can we avoid something like that happening again?
The book was after the fall. Yeah, was that it?
No, the book came out. This young man.
No, but the title of it, I didn't hear the title.
Stealing from a Deep Place.
No, I don't know the book, but
delightful.
Okay.
Very well written.
Now I will look it up. We certainly did make an error with respect to Nicolae Ceausescu. It's not an error that we haven't made before and made in many, many other parts of the world. Not just communist parts of the world. That is to say, to see dictators, people who rule authoritatively, and of course by the latter years, Ceausescu had exceeded authoritarianism, whatever that is, and had gone way over the brink to some bizarre tyranny. But we make the same mistake. We think that relations with a particular leader are in our larger national interest vis-a-vis some larger danger. And for many, many years, of course, it was the Soviet Union, it was world communism. And because Nikolai Ceausescu sounded like he was anti-Soviet and had a few foreign policies vis-a-vis Israel and some other things that were not like the Soviet Union, we saw him as a maverick, therefore useful to us. And I'm one who believes the United States has made a lot of mistakes in foreign policy by cozying up to a lot of people merely because they seem to be of interest to a larger goal, you know, security vis-a-vis the Soviet Union very often. You know, we see somebody as, you know, Marcos, for example. You know, Ferdinand Marcos. We can talk about other people who have been of the same ilk. Certainly not Democrats. Certainly not interested in the rule of law. Now, Nikolai Ceausescu, at the time, that is late 60s, early 70s, had the image of being anti-Soviet. Of course, we erroneously assumed that he was anti-Soviet in the same way we were. Of course, it had nothing to do with it. He was also significantly crafty in recognizing that if he sounded anti-Soviet, he would gain greater credibility in Washington and so on. And as we later found out, it was a good place to stock up on whatever purchases he or Elena Ceausescu or their family wanted to make and visit their bank accounts and so on. We did correct our image of Ceausescu, but it was much too late. We began the Congress, not the president. We began to say there's a problem with the human rights situation in Romania in the mid-80s. And we began to move away from it. But it was very... I know we're running out of time. It was too late. We should have done it earlier. We should have recognized that he... You know, kind of like FDR said of Somoza, and if you'll pardon my exact quote, Somoza in Nicaragua, he's an SOB, but our SOB. Well, I mean, the assumption was that with respect to Ceausescu, you know, he's reprehensible, but at least he's kind of on our side. Nothing could have been further from the truth. You know, he was a bizarre Balkan tyrant, and that began to be more and more evident with time. What the lesson to learn here, and Ceausescu isn't the only teacher, but the lesson to learn is make judgments of leaders on the basis of principle, not on the basis of this vague thing called national interest vis-a-vis some larger adversary, because very often that principle is stronger, more lasting, and more powerful than any kind of temporary alliance and stratagem with one of these small dictators. So I think we made a mistake with Ceausescu. We learned late, but now let's remember the larger lesson.
Mr. Fernbeck and Colonel Foote will ask the first question at our next Miller Center forum.
I pass.
We thank you very much, and we thank especially.